Good evening, everybody. Welcome to our keynote address on the fourth day of the 2011 Festival of Ideas. I'd like to acknowledge the traditional people of the land on which the university stands, the Wurundjeri people of the Kulin Nations. I'd also like to remind you in the audience that you should turn your phones off or to silent. You're permitted to tweet at HFOI11. HFOI11. So you may tweet, but that's done in silence. And can I just, someone's phone will go off during the proceedings, and you don't want to be that person, do you? So please check your phones. The proceedings will be filmed, especially during question time. If you leap to your feet to ask a question, do remember that you're on camera. And there will be time for questions at the end of Professor Clark's presentation. And I should also note a vote of thanks to the Visual Arts Board of the Australia Council, whose international visitor program has supported Professor Clark's visit here this evening. It's my pleasant duty to say a few words of introduction, and a few words it will be. Professor Clark arrives in Melbourne from London, having recently retired as the George C. and Helen N. Pardee Chair as Professor of Modern Art at the University of California, Berkeley. And he celebrated his retirement by taking a position as Visiting Professor of Art History at the University of York, and like many recent retirees, is preparing to work harder than ever before. So, Tim, we're grateful that you're able to make the time to join us here at the Festival of Ideas. Tim's career encompasses some of the world's great universities, UCLA, Harvard, UC Berkeley. And his many publications address some of the most monumental and recalcitrant artists in the Western canon, Poussin, Pollock, Picasso, Manet. Tim's engagement with artists such as those, I think, brings subtle resonances to a forum reflecting on identity and especially Australian identity. In his Image of the People, Tim presented us with Gustave Courbet crashing through the Parisian art world like a bull in a china shop. And that's a gesture emulated with, in much more modest terms, by many Australian artists abroad. Tim's painting of modern life recast French Impressionism around the figures of the city, recreation and capital. And recent interpretations of Australian Impressionism have been profoundly influenced by that reading. Tim opens his most recent book, The Sight of Death, by remarking that once or twice in the pages that follow, I step back for a moment and think about the implications of what I'm doing. That is, in fact, a gross understatement. The character and the impact of that book lies in the fact that Tim steps back to think about what he's doing in virtually every sentence. And that's what makes him such an interesting speaker within a festival discussing the pursuit of identity, or if I can play with it a little, the pursuit of ideas. And one of the key figures in The Sight of Death is the question of how one might articulate an idea about painting or about a painting. Is it a matter of identifying the content of a painting, or of reconstructing the artist's idea, or of spotting some telling detail that somehow unravels an embedded code, or of appending a painting to a larger narrative, perhaps one about national identity, as if the painting were an illustrative case? Now, none of those approaches generate ideas that satisfactorily address what Tim identifies as the peculiar challenges of paintings. They're there before us, on the wall, in a museum, in their materiality, in our here and now, yet, as he notes, always resistant in their silence and in their self-sufficiency. Tim's distinctive voice as an art historian rests not on endlessly reflexive acknowledgement of our distance from those paintings on the wall, but on an act that's fundamental to the encounter, the act of looking, looking at length, looking over and over. That's where ideas about art take shape, because as Tim notes in The Sight of Death, astonishing things happen if one gives oneself over to the process of seeing again and again. When Tim delivered the Mellon Lectures in the Fine Arts at the National Gallery of Art in Washington in 2009, a press report described him as one of our era's greatest thinkers about art, which was one of those rare occasions when journalistic hyperbole transubstantiated into plain fact, for it is a plain fact. We might debate as part of this festival what our era is, but there's no debating the importance of Tim's writing. Welcome, Tim.
Thank you very, very much, Chris. Characteristically generous and thoughtful. I want to say, first of all, I would really love it if you would kill those lights. Because you're going to see the images so much better if we don't have those lights on. So can you do that? Is it allowed? Or it'll probably mean we can't be seen on some internet site or something. But anyway, I am asking, okay, whatever. it's the usual battle, that art historians have between wanting you to see how beautiful the pictures are and the situation. I just want to say, first of all, that it really is a great honour to be speaking in this extraordinary sequence of events. I've had a great few days, and I'm very, very grateful to Patrick McGahey and to Chris McAuliffe for their part in making this happen, and to Rosalind Holloway for her help all through. Just one health warning, I shall not be speaking about Australian landscape painting. I'll be speaking about landscape painting, but not Australian landscape painting. Patrick must have realized this when he asked me. I'm not speaking about it because I don't think I know enough about it. And in particular, I hadn't seen enough of the real stuff. I'd never actually seen the Melbourne collection, which I've been catching up on. With delight this week. But I'm hoping that in speaking about the landscape painting that I know, the 19th century and 17th century landscape painting of Europe and America, there will be resonances. I think there will be. So I start from a poem by Elizabeth Bishop. It's a poem about a painting. And for all I know, Bishop's biographers have discovered and published the painting, but I want it to exist only in our mind's eye for the moment. It is, Bishop tells us, about the size of an old-style dollar bill. It must be Nova Scotia. Only there does one see gabled wooden houses painted that awful shade of brown. Elm trees, low hills, a thin church steeple, that grey-blue wisp, or is it? In the foreground, a water meadow with some tiny cows, two brush strokes each, but confidently cows. Cold early spring, clear as grey glass, a half inch of blue sky below the steel-grey storm clouds. They were the artist's specialty. A speck-like bird is flying to the left, or is it a fly speck looking like a bird? Heavens, I recognize the place. I know it. It's behind, I can almost remember the farmer's name, his barn backed on that meadow. There it is, titanium white, one dab, the hint of steeple, filaments of brush hairs, barely there, must be the Presbyterian church. Would that be Miss Gillespie's house? So, do landscapes have identities? Well, heavens yes. I recognize the place. I know it. And even before Elizabeth Bishop saw the Presbyterian Church and Miss Gillespie's house, she knew it must be Nova Scotia by the sheer awfulness of the house paint. Landscapes have identity written all over them, all the more so for the scenes they show being small, this one was very small, or provincial, or indeed colonial. Your Uncle George, Bishop remembers being told as the painting emerged from the trunk, your Uncle George left them all with Mother when he went back to England. You know, he was quite famous, an RA. Presumably then, Uncle George knew what he was painting and what, as an English RA, he thought about it. But did he know why he considered it paintable in the first place and how, as he painted, it turned out? That, I think, is Elizabeth Bishop's question and mine. Do landscapes have identities? Again, yes. Art history's treatment of landscape painting for the past quarter century has surely been right to distrust the ordinariness and immediacy that seems to come with the genre, and see the play of interests even in the geese and steeple. And the interests don't have to be as gross and duplicitous as, say, Lord So-and-so's wishing to have a record of the latest improvements to the land he just enclosed. Anyone who finds a landscape interesting enough to paint, Uncle George, for instance, is bound to make it somehow consonant with human understanding and draw its parts into a kind of totality. A scene must have a character. Nonetheless, Elizabeth Bishop is talking, her deadpan first list of features is talking, about something else fundamental to landscape painting and our response to it, which I think has been lost hold of in most of what we art historians now write. And this is what I want to talk about today. I'm interested in what it is in landscape and landscape painting that escapes from our human efforts to make the material world ours, make it part of what we own and what we understand. The world of Miss Gillespie, the world, the scene that is immediately Nova Scotia. I shall offer a painting to stand for this. Let's see whether we can get to it. Yeah, well, as usual, good. A bit dark, this slide. That's why I would love those lights to go, but never mind. I shall offer a painting to stand for this, done not much earlier than Uncle George's, certainly in Uncle George's lifetime, Cézanne's House near Gardanne, probably part of a campaign by the painter in the town and its outskirts that we know happened in the mid-1880s. Much of this lecture will be an attempt to understand the interests and non-interests in play here. Obviously, the Bishop words dimness, and that's one of her words, and smallness, this literal small backwater she calls the place in her picture, won't quite apply to the Cézanne. House near Gardanne is not large, it's 26 inches high and 32 inches wide, but it has a formidable implied scale. That's why it does so well, this big. It isn't clear how high the mountain range in the background is, but high enough to be stern and remote. Yet the scene as a whole isn't wild. The house and fields and stunted remains of an orchard are ordinary and modest, part of a world Uncle George would recognize. Bishop says of the form of attention in the picture she's looking at that vision is too serious a word for it. Look is better, she says. Cézanne is looking. Plainness or givenness won't quite do to describe what he sees, because the ordinariness of the scene seems to be infused at the same time by a kind of distance, an apartness, an unfamiliarity. And yet, uncanniness is wrong. The quality in the scene, and it's a quality that seems to me characteristic of Cézanne at his best, is, if I can put it like this, familiarity and unfamiliarity coexisting, or nearness and apartness. Look at the painting's bottom 6 inches. The material world is close to us, they say. It's where we are, what we are in. But our place in it, our entry into it, its distance and proximity to us, it's offering us a ground or a way. These are thoroughly unstable. And the instabilities aren't marginal or outlandish in relation to human occupation of the world. They're ordinary. They go with the plainness and sobriety. I'm going to apply various words to this aspect of landscape painting. One of them you'll see is the moment of materiality in landscape, or of mere materiality, that titanium white one dab. Landscape's insignificance would be another way of putting it, and the fact of that insignificance being central to some painters choosing the genre at all. They are wanting to preserve the insignificance of looking in the painting itself. I like the moment in Van Gogh's Letters where he writes to Theo about this painting, House on the Rue Lamartine, which is still underway. The house on the left, he says, is pink with green shutters. I mean the one in the shadow of the tree. It's the restaurant where I go for dinner every day. Millet, he was Van Gogh's companion, thinks all this is horrible. But I needn't tell you that when he says he can't understand why anyone would amuse himself doing such a dreary grocer's shop and such stark, stiff houses with not a trace of gracefulness to them, remember that Zola did a certain boulevard at the beginning of L'Assommoir, and Flaubert at the beginning of Bouvard et Pécuchet, a corner of the Quai de la Villette during the dog days of summer, and neither of them has gone moldy yet. Ordinariness, then. A nondescript corner in the dusty heat, 4 or 5 stiff houses, and a great desert of half-dug-up yellow. Ordinariness is a trope. It has a great literary pedigree. It may be a little hard for us, looking at House on the Rue Lamartine, to see starkness and dreariness as the qualities that matter. But ordinariness often goes together with exaggeration. Familiarity needs to be defamiliarized in order for mere materiality to appear. Insignificance is an effect of style. So again, my subject is what it is in our surroundings that resists or eludes our normal terms of understanding, and above all, our effort to make the surroundings ours, to make them continuous with our human categories and our human place. The word that I think sums this up is the difficult one, non-identity. I'm going to argue that one of the great strengths of landscape painting as a genre is that in practice it found ways of registering the non-identity of nature. But by this I don't mean that painting ended up making landscape unrecognizable or even threateningly strange. Rather, the opposite. There's a kind of landscape painting I want to show that is interested in the utter ordinariness, the simple being there of the world we find ourselves in, but is struck by the strangeness of the ordinariness. There it is, the world we know. But how do we know it, and where are we in it? Are the usual identities we give it, here a house, there an orchard, there a famous mountain in Provence, are they what counts in our actual encounter with it? Aren't the identities always haunted by something more basic and mysterious, something that puts our whole inhabiting of landscape in doubt? This is what I want the word non-identity to stand for. Let me start thinking about this by focusing on the notion of way in landscape, the way humans make through the world, and landscape painting's reflection on such matters. I realize actually, and you know, increasingly, that many of these things I'm saying about landscape painting are peculiarly interesting and charged in relation to the Australian Indigenous art of the last 20 years, and of course before. I didn't fully understand that resonance, but I think it's there. The way. I go back to the bottom 6 inches of House Near Gardanne, if the machine will allow me, which it won't. All right, wait a minute. Oh, good. No, yes. So it's leapt over. Let me go back. There we go. I'll do it manually, I think. I go back to the bottom 6 inches of House Near Gardanne, to the questions concerning ground and weigh-in and nearness and farness I've already pointed to. These questions are fundamental. In not offering the viewer a ground or a way, Cézanne was contradicting one of landscape's deepest assumptions or purposes, so deep that it's hard to decide which word of the two just used, assumption or purpose, is the right one. At this point, I need an enormously strong and considered example of this kind of purpose served. And the one I shall use, if you've just already glimpsed, is this Ruysdael's large forest from around 1660, now in Vienna. Cézanne never saw the painting, but he saw many like it. And I believe it was this strand in the landscape tradition, the Dutch strand, and the 19th century French and English moments deriving from it, that he thought embodied what landscape was most powerfully capable of, and what therefore his own landscapes must ingest and also leave behind. You'll see that Ruysdael offers his viewer, remember the painting is enormous in comparison with Cézanne's, 4.5 feet high and close on 6 feet wide, Ruysdael offers his viewer a way in, and maybe a way through the world. There's a track through the woods, and wayfarers, just about glimpsome, stopping by woods, to use Robert Frost's shop-worn phrase, is a recurrent landscape figure, and is often touched by Frost's ambivalence about how long to stay put. The track in Ruysdael is wonderfully materialized, and the cart ruts speak to its being incorporated into a world of commerce and production. Maybe even a recreation. The far couple on the path seem to have time to kill. But the way in Ruysdael is not crassly complacent to human needs or even orientation. The road is carved through sand, or soil that looks not much use to a farmer. And the access it offers us, especially in relation to the picture's bottom edge, is off-center, oblique. And of course, it immediately goes underwater. The water isn't deep, and the path soon resurfaces. A ford isn't a threat. The view of the path under the water is beautiful. The painting turns on it. But this cuts both ways. We gain entry into the painting's world, but we have a moment of looking down at the entry, the joining of place to place, through the clear, fast stream whose flood banks are duly noted. Ruysdael, then, is Cézanne's opposite, but his opposition is shot through with a consciousness of an extraordinary invention of signs for what is involved in making the material world available. The exact balance of light and shade in the picture, of uncertainty in the weather, and of shadow not quite becoming gloom, is, as so often in landscape painting that matters, a further carrier of such thought. We might say, returning to space and ground specifically, that Cézanne does no more than bring Ruysdael's out-of-the-wayness up to the surface. If that out-of-the-wayness hadn't been there in the landscape tradition, Cézanne's art would have been more captious and paradoxical than it is. For again, out-of-the-wayness is not a dominant in House Near Gardanne. We're not put down in a wilderness or no man's land. What we are shown is an entirely ordinary stretch of farmland. Van Gogh, in Flaubert mood, would have approved of it. The landscape tradition is capacious, I'm saying. It is subtle, it is intense, as well as being often bland and obtuse. Inevitably, it works with repeated figures of human occupation, the way through the world, the rest by the wood, the shelter of the clearing, and so on. But the paintings that matter are always conscious of these stories and structures as invented and contingent, one way of looking at things. Ruysdael's story is subtle, and I think it responds to an equally subtle treatment of such questions that Ruysdael would have been able to see in Rembrandt, who was working on landscape at the very same moment. This etching, great etching, of course, famous etching, for example, was made in 1651. Ruysdael's view of Naarden, by contrast, up above, a few miles southeast of Amsterdam on the Zuider Zee, was done 4 years earlier than the Rembrandt in 1647. The traditional title of the Rembrandt is The Gold Weigher's Field. It's somehow deeply satisfactory that the field turns out not to have belonged to a big state dignitary, right, with the monopoly on gold weighing, but to one of Rembrandt's ordinary creditors from whom he purchased disastrously his oversized townhouse. The view, such as it is of Haarlem on the left horizon, Saxenburg, even less of an interruption, the church at Bloemendaal, and three long strip fields with laborers bleaching linen. The comparison with Ruysdael is endlessly interesting, but let me stick to matters of ways in and ways through. There is one in the Rembrandt, the repeated strokes of the needle and the strong shadow cast by the bit of curb to the left establish that. There's a road. There is a way, but almost nothing in the etching. No figure on the path, as in Ruysdael. No movement from dark to light to dark toward the town gives the way any depth or narrative authority. It swerves off left and disappears. The land breaks up into roughly equal but non-equivalent segments: fields, polders, dune land, a low wood, an arm of the sea. Touch, above all, the deliberate blur of the etcher's needle, touch colluding with this strange stretched format. All of this conjures the world away for all the firmness of our first 10 or 20 strides into it. Or maybe conjures the world away is forcing the note. Because again, as in House Near Gardanne, it's not that nature becomes in the least excessive or formidable here. Ruysdael's Naarden is more dramatic, but more that its familiarity, almost its banality, becomes something strange in its own right. We are in a world, and the world could not be more ordinary, but how we are in it and where we are in it is what the etching makes strange. Could we say we are in it, but it isn't ours? This too, I think, this not belonging to us, this strange quality of nowhereness, became part of the landscape tradition. Ruysdael spoke back to it years later in his Views of Haarlem from the Dunes. They're astonishing and surely self-conscious refutations of the Rembrandt, with way now all but replaced by straight line, measurement, interval, the geometry of the linen bleaching in the fields repeated by the Cartesian clarity of the sunny intervals. refutations of Rembrandt, but even more, it looks like, replies to the artist who was most capable of translating Rembrandt's proposal into paint. I mean, Koninck. In the rush of paintings done round 1655, this is one of them, great painting in the Rijksmuseum. I have in mind particularly Koninck's middle grounds, with their inscrutable balance of solid human organization and impalpable perceptual contingency. The nearer, the neater and more decent the pattern of use here, the more approximate its hold on substance. Again, I like the idea of Koninck being literally an investor in what he's showing. Later in life, he owned an inland shipping line between Rotterdam and Amsterdam. If his painting usually expresses caution about prospects, a feeling, that is, for the uncertainty of business climates or of business in climates like these, it was caution, not unwillingness to place bets. Let me recap the story so far. I'm not disputing that landscape painting is very often about ownership and habitation and a stabilizing and celebrating of the world we live in. As I say, Koninck was literally a proprietor of what he painted. But he also seems interested, doesn't he, in what it is, threaded all through our being in and seeing the world, that just doesn't fit the confident categories we usually deploy, that slips through them and puts us somewhere we've never quite been before. This is something the landscape tradition allows him to investigate. At this point, I see a possible objection. What I've shown you so far are wholly remarkable paintings, and yet I seem to be talking constantly about something called the landscape tradition. Can I have it both ways? Is a tradition made up of masterpieces, or even fairly represented, even in its strengths, by them? In what sense is what I've shown you so far a tradition at all, or even a set of possibilities the tradition actually provided for painters on the ground? What about Uncle George? Well, I don't know enough about Dutch painting in the 17th century to answer these questions with any confidence, but about painting in some of Europe in the 19th century, I think I can. A tradition is indeed not represented by its masterpieces, and the landscape tradition least of all. For landscape is a banal genre. Banality is its forte. Even the landscape masterpiece has to have ordinariness as its lifeblood. So, of course, the landscape non-masterpiece, and there are plenty of them, will have it as its blood and skin and skeleton and nerve ending. And therefore, in its dim-witted innocence, it will be guilty of all the things art history has convicted it of in the last 30 years. Interestedness and slavish subservience to the pastoral of the enclosures, blind eyes to anyone working the fields more untidily than the linen bleachers, cranked up tourism in faraway places, cultivated ignorance about whom Yosemite or Derwentwater, or indeed Australia, belonged to before the troops and trains arrived, and camp imitation of day trippers' jollity along the prom. Landscape painting's guilty of all that. Of course that's right. Nonetheless, I do think the set of possibilities I've been talking about were also part of the tradition. The moment of materiality, or the sense that nature presented itself most characteristically from somewhere in between. These became ordinary proposals, or better, facts of practice. Here, for instance, is a painting by the Dane, Johan Thomas Lundby, done in 1842. It's called Open Country in North Zealand. The painting is a good medium 19th century size, just over 3 feet by 4. And it's not unusual. It's the kind of painting we pass by in a crowded gallery in Copenhagen, or maybe even in Federation Square, and nod to familiarly. It's not unusual, but worth pausing in front of. I'm sure, I'm very sad it's so dark there, but just bear with me. Questions then crop up, I feel. What is this a painting of? What is its point of view, so to speak? Why does it have a horizon this high, and cows this small, and a boulder and dock leaves this near and this big? You can just about see them bottom left. When the painting first attracted my attention, I thought the word nondescript seemed right for it. And this brought into focus the fact that by 1842, there was an established subset of landscape, almost a genre within the genre, to which that word applied as some kind of positive. The nondescript as the opposite of the picturesque, or maybe as a new form of the picturesque. Of course, Lumbye's painting is conventional in many ways. It's long way in on the diagonal, and the pattern of shadow through the wood, and the low, far country with its church tower and town, and even the nature of cloud in the sky. We've been here before. Familiar formats, one commentator reminds us that Lumbye had spent time in Italy, have been slightly tipped, slightly flattened. And ideologically, at the top of his citizen mind, it doesn't seem that Lumbye had the least idea that what resulted in Open Country in North Zealand was at all equivocal or strange. What I, as an artist, have taken as the goal of my life is to paint our beloved Denmark in all its simplicity and lack of pretension, which are so typical of it. This is from a diary started the same year as this painting. What beauty there is in the fine drawn contours of our hills, billowing so miraculously that one could believe them risen from the sea. What beauty in our forests, our meadows, and our heaths. Ideologically, then, Lumbye is a landscape bad guy, a nationalist, a naturalizer, a seeker after simplicity and lack of pretension, following the crowd, we might say. But I'm proposing that there is, or can be, a difference between landscape ideology and landscape practice. Lumbye is a good because ordinary example. I don't think that the landscape of billowing hills and beloved simplicity quite gets hold of what happened when Lumbye put ideology into practice. The language is an adequate frame. I'm not suggesting that anything in the picture escapes from a kind of nationalist dreaming, but it doesn't, in my view, get us on terms with the thing it is framing. It has nothing much to say about the picture's nondescriptness, about the question the image brings on, and again, it's a recurrent 19th century question of why here? Why from this angle? Why this particular closeness to the ground or precise equivocation about where the road goes when it dips unshowily out of sight? I think I can produce a period eye, or at least a period voice, to help us. Here are the last two verses of a poem written probably 10 years later than the Lumbye and published in 1855. I'll have a drink of water. Botch this, it's really beautiful. I crossed a moor with a name of its own and a certain use in the world, no doubt. Yet a hand's breadth of it shines alone mid the blank miles round about. For there I picked up on the heather, and there I put inside my breast a moulted feather, an eagle feather. Well, I forget the rest. It's Browning. marvellous poem called Memorabilia. Now, I'm not saying the verses are a match for the Lumbee, and least of all am I saying that in practice, in painting, Lumbee simply forgot the rest. The certain use of the Moor in the world, no doubt, is still there in the Lumbee. Language, poetry, is better able to leave things out completely. But I do think that landscape painting could be a form of forgetting, for a moment, partially, and that the painting culture of landscape in the 19th century came to turn on this forgetting. The mad idea of a painting of instantaneity, of the world compressed into an unrepeatable spot of time, was the logical conclusion of this. And yes, in many of its forms, forgetting in landscape painting was simply escapism. But not always. Cézanne is again our example. The fact that his painting came, it seems necessarily, out of the culture of immediacy and instantaneity, and yet the words instant and eternity seem to apply equally well in the case of House Near Gardin. This should give us pause. Let me put Gardin and Zeeland side by side. There is a kind of landscape painting which I want to celebrate, or at least argue we ought to recognize, that is interested in a world that crops up between places. When the somewhere the viewer looks out from ceases to be interesting because it's on the way to the wood or the far horizon, and we are for a moment just in the world, just somewhere, and wanting to stay in the somewhere for no reason we can put a name to. It might attach this wanting to stay here to something, an eagle feather or a stone on the path, but these are alibis. It's the just being somewhere that counts. Just being somewhere, forgetting the rest. Having one's hand or brush encounter a stone or a feather for no reason one can put a name to. These are the aspects of landscape practice I want us to take seriously again. Let me try to step back and think about this. Your favorite phrase, Chris, which you picked up. Yeah. Let me try to step back and think about this idea more generally with the broad arc of human dealings with nature in mind. The painting that can, I believe, bear the weight of this kind of generalization is another Ruysdael. A tremendous one, part of a series showing the town of Egmond aan Zee in among the dunes by the edge of the sea, 15 miles or so north of Haarlem. It's wonderful in the Australian context that this is all about remoteness. Right? We're about 35 kilometers from Amsterdam, right? Yeah. The picture was painted around 1650, again in proximity to the gold weighers' field and Koenig's panoramas done 30-odd miles away. It's now in Stockholm, this particular picture. Maybe it helps to get the measure of the subject, its treatment of habitation and isolation, I mean, if I tell you that the choir of the town's proud church was already a ruin at the time Ruysdael painted it, though the nave was still in use. The church lasted another century. Its last remains fell down in 1743. Nearing town is as much a landscape trope, of course, as stopping by woods. Ruysdael works with established forms. Egmond is picturesque. Compare the travellers on the path here with the man in the large forest. But what Ruysdael does with the trope, the whole picture of human encampment at the edge of the sea, the painting's measure of gloom and sunlight, is stupendous. And even the trope is extraordinary if we consider it in relation to human history as a whole. To look in this way at human habitation from the outside, to be interested in remoteness and insecurity, in the sheer strangeness of the places humans try to make their own. To have the church be as much a figure of vulnerability as endurance, built on sand more than rock, and simply to put this stress on weather. I want to lay hold again of this moment in the history of a middle-class, commercial, world-colonizing republic. All this as a world historical event. No doubt in the background here is the word secularization. Is this what the moment of materiality adds up to? Historians recently have been interested in the effect of the Reformation on the question of the land and its new natural and supernatural components. Ruysdael's half-ruined church is left behind from the Catholic past, remember, and may be part of the Protestant congregation's willingness to let its choir go on mouldering away had to do with their unease at the church's grandeur. But the historians want to convince us that old habits as regards the natural world and its sacred or magical being for us died hard. Secularization came slowly, against the odds of the sacred. This is what makes the Ruysdael so enormous, along with the other Dutch paintings I've shown. In rather the same way as one-point perspective in painting, anticipated by two centuries, the fundamental model of Cartesian epistemology, this cluster of paintings from around 1650 seems to look forward to a much, much later disenchanted world. Or does the sun on the path still bring out enchantment? But surely it's the things, the huddle of houses, the omnipresence of the awful shade of brown that matter. Let's accept then that the natural deep structure of human dealings with the realm of necessity, with nature, was to conceive that realm as shaped and animated by supernatural forces. Of course, the world was peopled by, or concentrated in, charged, familiar, more than human forms, a pool by a rock with healing powers, a swift or ruthless animal, the wind in a certain quarter, a kind of plant or fruit, a poison or a hallucinogen. We should remind ourselves that this is the normal abiding way that land, sea, and air are for us. It is the kind of mapping and memorizing that proved for the immense majority of the species' existence effective, adaptive, that is, conducive to the group's passing on of knowledge and action in common in face of the elements. Several things follow for landscape painting. If there was to be, slowly and painfully, a process of secularization, it would happen most potently with the most intense tug of war in the imagination around this basic animating of the object world. I turn to House near Gardanne. What do I mean, now in a bit more detail, by speaking of non-identity appearing in it, or the moment of materiality, or its putting in doubt the normal structure of our dealings with the object world? Let me speak first to the overall look of the painting, how it might strike a viewer in the opening few seconds from across the room. Because it's this apperception, this strange first non-totality that is the Cézanne effect, more than any subsequent local disturbance or nuance. I want to call this look of a Cézanne the look of a landscape being intercepted. And again, in order to establish the force of this look, what it does to the landscape genre, why it's crucial to the moment of materiality, I have to speak broadly about the tradition. Non-identity, we've seen already, is bound up with a new kind of framing of the scene, a new kind of implied relation between what we are looking at and what is off screen. a great deal of landscape painting's persuasiveness and pathos. I don't understand why this has been so little talked about. Has always depended on a painting's ability to imply or seemingly lead to the world not included in the rectangle. By and large, a successful landscape painting has convinced its viewer most powerfully by reason of its ability to signal, to structure, to insinuate kinds of suggested continuity between its small world and the world at large. Any scene is an extract, but the extract the painter offers us is most often given its typicality. This is the painting's claim, by some familiar accident of nature itself. A clearing, that central word, a glimpse into distance through trees, a stopping place, a sandy or grassy bank, the shelter of a tree. I take Poussin's Rest by the Fountain here to be a conspectus of these devices or wishes. And apropos landscape and enchantment, it's wonderful that the great tree in the center background against which the old philosopher has propped himself is hung with effigies and totems. How extraordinary, by the way, that this and the gold weighers' field are maybe done 2 or 3 years apart. The world in landscape, Poussin tells us, carries on in the way the picture shows it does. It's not the least uncanny aspect of House near Gardanne that it seems packed full with things, fields, paths, mountain ranges, continuing horizontally off frame, but that why this particular section of the continuum is presented to us and what the particular section does to the very idea of continuity should be so completely obscure. There is a nick of white paint where the mountain meets the picture edge at top left. You can actually see it, echoing the weird nick of blue at the top of the nearby escarpment. The white seems almost a signal that the painting stops, breaks, just where its edge happens to be, and has nothing to say about where the mountain goes next. Fritz Novotny was pointing to something fundamental in Cézanne when he suggested that one key to his painting's strangeness was simply the section of the visible. The width of vision, even more than the famous non-depth of focus, he seemed now to see as paintable. How much, how wide a section of the world. The moment of materiality, then, is partly a question of making the off-frame a real absentee. The painting is not an epitome. The world is intercepted in representation, not gathered in or spread out or arrested at a wonderful turn in the road. Interception, I talked about this earlier, is bound up with a destabilizing of the great metaphor ground. Ground in the landscape tradition being a figure, of course, of groundedness, firm footing, good standing, knowing where we are. Maybe it should surprise us that the encounter with matter in landscape often happens most strongly when these metaphors of grounding cease to work. The field and path in Cézanne are thinned, almost dematerialized. There is no fall of light to solidify them. Their slope and extent are perplexing, and their continuity with us, with the imagined place we stand in to look from, more and more a puzzle. No ground and no distance. Art historians have labored mightily to find the spot where Cézanne actually put up his easel to paint House near Gardanne, but they've had to admit defeat. And it must be, the sanest of them concedes, having trumped the hills in vain, that Cézanne, wherever he stood, chose to leave out a whole series of intermediate hills and foothills and escarpments, and all but collapse the interval between the house and the high mountain range. I want to do no more faced with this typical great fact of the way Cézanne saw than think it in relation to Connick and Ruysdael. Distance in landscape is teleology. It opens a way through the world. It is temporality. It puts us again at the start of a quest or at the end of a climb. Meantime, we gain the height. There is no height in House Near Gardanne. Never have mountains been less incommensurate with the mid-scale world nearby, and therefore no meantime. I proceed to the house. Again, what's at issue for me in the Cézanne is the house's identity or lack of it and its place in nature. If the house is the human, a figure for us really, our inhabiting, then how does Cézanne seem to think the human fits in the world? The house, as I've said, is off-center in the landscape, but not in a way that immediately stands for everything being out of whack. Cézanne can be much more unsettling with houses if he wants to. He tips the mansion at Just de Buffon more relentlessly. I mean, this is a wonderful companion piece I'll return to in a minute. He, and show you another one. He tips the house at Just de Buffon more relentlessly and pushes it off weirdly to one side. The farm at Bellevue, a motif he returned to, he makes devolve, almost exfoliate into its surroundings with more of the feel of a labyrinth. All right, so the house near Gardanne is by no means a strange and off-center, off-kilter, as he often can be. Yet, it is strange. The way it relates to the things that abut it and the way its sides are stressed or interrupted have always arrested the painter's admirers. Meyer Shapiro wrote about this beautifully, and I'll just run a little with Shapiro's train of thought. The house is a clearly lit, sharply delineated solid. The left-hand edge of its facade, for instance, could hardly be clearer. And a tree that seems to be rooted in front of the facade, oh, I better go back just to show you that, right? The tree on the left-hand side. A tree that seems to be rooted in front of the facade packs its leaves out of sight round the corner so as to leave the straight edge undisturbed. The other front corner, this is the kind of thing Cézanne used to dine out on, is all but masked by a tree, or maybe two trees pretending to be one. The wall at right, with a beautiful, willful geometry of dark windows and door all across it, ends at another straight line, but this one is half lost in among the lines of branches, and the whole end of the house at this side. There could be a further low wall to the right of the house, perhaps a pen for animals, reaches out to the strange trapezoid of the ploughed field. The roof is an exquisite floating relative of the hard-edged fields and rock faces. From the chimney, which registers as more or less at the picture's visual centre, there puffs out, here's the point of outright paradox, but only to confirm that paradox doesn't capture what's going on in general in the painting. But here, the chimney puffs out a plume of green smoke. Trees crowd up to the eaves of the house, sealing it in. The house seems to settle into the hill. Grass laps its right side like a wave. A great luminous staircase or water slide of grass and hay rises up to meet its front wall. The hay's yellow humming against the complementary violets in the half shadow. The hay bale, if it is a hay bale, maybe it's a hay bale, maybe it's a door. If it's a door, it's a door onto absolutely nothing. The hay bale on top of the pile opens the wall as much as casts an equivocal shadow on it. Between the bale and the blind niche up to the left, there is an interminable to and fro of solid and void, yellow and violet, coming forward and fading away. The wall and bale and spinning top of foliage are the whole of painting exemplified. Illusionism and its discontents. What is it these swaps and leakages and substitutions do to the house? They're none of them louder than sotto voce, but they fix the attention as only a whisper can. Do they make the house part of nature, folding things into it, analogizing its forms with those in the world at large? Well, I suppose so, partly. But for every fading and folding into the surroundings, there's still a hard edge. For every rhyming or merging shape, one as staccato as a hard consonant. Do the leakages end up annihilating the identity house altogether? Well, surely not. The house stands firm. It's where its identity ends that Cézanne seems uncertain about. How hard or porous are the house's limits? Parts of the world seem to be making an appearance in the house, and the house may be opening into its surroundings, we could almost say contaminating them, in ways that just slightly exceed or even poke fun at its man-made foursquareness. The material world overlaps it, enters it slightly. Landscape painting is a strange thing. When the Milanese Paolo Lomazzo wrote the first systematic account of the subject, that is, of course, in Europe, in 1584, he began in this extraordinary way, right? This is the first bit of European systematic writing on the subject. Those who have shown excellence and grace in this branch of painting, he says, both in private and public places, he knows that the genre already has a public dimension, have discovered various ways of setting about it, such as fetid, dark, underground places, religious and macabre, where they represent graveyards, tombs, deserted houses, sinister and lonesome sites, caves, dens, ponds and pools. Of course, he goes on to enumerate less strange and dreadful aspects of the world that landscape painters go for, but it's important that his list begins in the way it does. Of course, I like the fact, with House near Gardanne in mind, that the catalogue includes deserted houses and sinister, lonesome sites. I note that on either side in the list, there are graveyards and tombs and caves. This makes me want to juxtapose House near Gardanne to the great paintings of the Bibonus quarry that Cézanne did 10 years later, where the caves in the quarry have seemed to many viewers through the years to resonate with the tomb in the rock. And Lomazzo and Bibonus trigger the thought of the famous woodcut accompanying Serlio's treatment of the satiric scene in theatre, with its recommendation that satires, plays to do with common life of the body, not flinching from the body's absurd and scandalous functions, they should be played in front of a backdrop of caves, trees and cottages. It's the foreground of this woodcut that's most spellbinding, because it's not so much a cave as a quarry. The crudity of matter here is that of cut stone. The moment of materiality in landscape, then, is also a way of thinking the question of human labour. Landscapes, as we find them in the world, are overwhelmingly made things, the result of hard work and coercion. We were talking about this afternoon. Serlio's foreground speaks to that, but equally it points to the way the landscape tradition most often attempts to naturalize this madeness and blur the line between stone for sale and geological strata. The word quarry itself, with its undertones of the hunt and the prison farm, is absent from Lamazzo's list. For quarry, read cave. So yes, it's important that Cézanne's Provence never has people in it. Well, there's one exception. The quarry actually has one person in it, but looks utterly out of place. But we should not leap, in my view, from that elementary observation to a judgment on what the absence of peasants and livestock signifies. I mean, it is, of course, striking in comparison with somebody like Pizarro, or even Monet. Put House Near Jardin next to its companion piece that I showed you earlier, the painting with houses in the plural, by the look of it, done no more than a mile away. And now enter in what historians tell us about the landscape these two paintings share. That by the mid-1880s, Jardin, though still a sleepy hill town, was surrounded by coal fields, worked since the Middle Ages, a cement factory, potteries, lime works. The preponderant crop was tobacco. No doubt in the landscape tradition, emptiness, an empty building, is often a figure of ruin or abandonment. And this offers a kind of covert reassurance to us viewers. It puts us after the catastrophe, looking back on human occupation from nature's lofty point of view. In the Cézanne, by contrast, emptiness and fullness coincide. Occupation is everywhere, but the painting seems to want to dramatize the thinness of the occupation, its being a few inches deep. The house concentrates the general uneasy character of the scene. We, as viewers, are not put after anything, least of all in a place that nature has reclaimed. The non-catastrophe called farming is still in unpicturesque mid-flow. It's as if the image had been stopped by a pause button. I feel the struggle with the realm of necessity in every square inch. Put Goldwayer's Field next to a Cézanne done in the year of the Commune, probably, called the railway cutting up above. I'll end with this juxtaposition. The subject of both strange pictures seems to me the way humans take through the world they exploit. Way being meant quite literally here. Inhabiting means making roads and cuttings. The cutting is contingent, and therefore the pictures struggle to lay hold of this, I feel. Viewpoints are vestiges, instants always shot through if they're not lasting. Landscape at the deepest level is at odds with perspective. Lamazzo's list of horrors and undergrounds speaks to this. Landscape at its most intense, or the kind of intensity I've been trying to speak up for, impresses us as taken from the side of something whose front and center we'll never quite see. When Nietzsche said, it's a saying of his I love and I think we ought to take seriously, that French painting was the last metaphysical activity within European nihilism, I think he had paintings like the railway cutting in mind. And he meant, as I understand him, that painting was now the only practice of knowledge within a dissolving European culture that could convincingly put itself the question of being, the nature of things and our knowledge of them, the question of truth and illusion, the question of our not quite knowing where we are. No doubt we shall continue to be interested in where painters went to pose that question. Why a railway cutting after all? And whether the question was ever entirely separable from interests and bad thinking. Maybe even the railway cutting has a touch of railway mania about it. But not much is my feeling, and not to its detriment. Materialism, after all, can have its manic moments. I crossed a moor with a name of its own, and a certain use in the world, no doubt. But why I ended up painting this part of it, and why like this exactly, I don't know, or I've forgotten. Landscape painting is modest. It could be Rembrandt speaking, but it could be Uncle George. Thank you.
Thank you, Tim. Apparently I have to do a vote of thanks later, but I'll take some questions while I can think of something of substance to match your words. But there's now just let me remind, we've got time for a few questions. There are roving mics, so I'll catch your eye and wait for the mic to come to you, and off you go. There's our first. And I see one there, and I see another one, so I've got three in the chute already. Fire away, sorry.
Thank you. Thank you for that talk. That Cézanne is really quite a disturbing picture on first glance. And you wonder why the blue mountains behind seem to be from lunar blue and white, from another dimension is what I'm trying to say. And the house is in a sort of autumn warm light. But if you can go back to that slide, there's something in particular about it.
Yeah,
which I may be mistaken.
There we go.
Now I've got to find a full screen bit.
But if you look at
the... You answer the question, Tim, and I'll break the computer.
Okay.
There you go. Great.
You look at the shadows on that hay bale. They're on the right. And you look at the shadows on the cliffs directly above. They're on the left.
Yeah.
As if the cliffs above are being illuminated by the moon, perhaps.
Yeah.
On the right.
Yeah.
Shadows being thrown to the left, especially in the far left. That strange object down below is showing shadows to the right, including the lower shoulder of it, very dark shadows. So it's two different dimensions clashing, as far as illumination.
Or possibly two, absolutely right. That's marvellous that you're actually having a go at this painting, given the dire nature of this projection of it. but, you know, you're right, I think. The illumination of this painting. You see, look, the painting is much, much gentler and brighter and bluer than this monstrous image suggests. But you're right that there are clues to where light may be coming from. I don't really think if you saw the thing for real that you'd entertain the idea that it was moonscape in one part. But the light is the light has a certain uncanniness to it, and I agree with you that there are one or two clues to shadow falling that seem to suggest it's falling one way, and then up above you think, well, so illumination or lighting or the inconsistency of lighting, the ungraspability of light, very much part of all this strange investigation of what the world's like in relation to us.
I think you need to be at the flight deck here, Tim. There's another question there, and I've got it. There's another behind.
Yeah, it's interesting how in the development of modernity there was a lot of cross pollination between different art forms in the manifestation of paintings by people like Cézanne. It's interesting how a number of those other images you showed us were very, very skewed, very, very off-centre buildings, etc. To me, that's almost like ekphrasis. It's almost like a, a visual equivalent, a painterly equivalent of what someone like Bertolt Brecht was working with in the Wolfram Dunks effect. It's that alienation, that distanciation, which then engenders some kind of other level of meaning. Have you got any thoughts on that?
Yeah. I mean, I sort of I agree and don't agree with that, right? You know, this, you, if I may say so, is the voice of the great 20th century tradition, right, of obsession with Cézanne as the artist of strangeness and dislocation and alienation. And look, that's part of it. That's part of it. But I want to say that the true Cézanne effect, again, if you saw how luminous and gentle this picture is in reality, right? That actually a Cézanne, because Cézanne, of course, gloried in colour. So he puts us in the middle of the world, right? He doesn't completely, I mean, the world is strange, but we're there in it. We're delighting in it. It's sort of enveloping us, and yet we don't know how. We don't know how we get there. So it's that sort of coexistence of the alienation with the at-homeness, really, which is so extraordinary.
The ordinariness.
Yeah, yeah.
There's another question.
At the end of question time, would it be possible to turn the lights out and then flick through the photo, through the
I know, wouldn't it be paintings? Nice? Wouldn't it be nice? You know what it is? It's the rule of internet. You know, it's the rule of the internet. They won't turn them off because it's being filmed.
Now, what I mean, when you've finished this presentation, we'll possibly have the lights out and then run through the paintings again so we can actually see the colours.
That would be nice, wouldn't it?
Yes, it would be.
Yes, yes.
Or you could look at the whole thing again on the internet. Yeah. Now, well, I think we've got time for one more and... No?
Because, you know, it's all playing into my hands because, as you may or may not know, I'm kind of an absolute neo-Luddite, so it's very, very nice that I can grouse and grumble about. You know.
Well, you've done... Tim, I think we'll hold it there and I'll just bellow across the room and not use the technology. My vote of thanks is simply this, for encouraging us all to look and look again and again and again. I think if there's one thing that will militate against the tyranny of the internet with its nanoseconds of engagement is to spend a solid hour in the company of one painting and one voice. And I think that's the bedrock for me and I think for many of you in an attempt to re-engage with the image in a productive rather than glib and instantaneous way. So thanks again.
Thank you very much
for your talk.
Thank you.